So today, you know, we're going to get into, you know, physical and then emotional, spiritual recovery, cover some of the topics. And so we'll start with the physical. And, you know, again, it's all in the steps. But how do we apply those steps in the physical aspect, in the physical realm? And we'll get into abstinence, because really, that's our entrance ticket to recovery, is abstinence. It's not the end result, it's the entrance ticket. Okay. The thing to think about with step one, you know, came to believe that we're compulsive overeaters, or anorexics, bulimics, whatever the, you know, identification may be, and that our lives had become unmanageable. You know, those are two separate things. You know, I suffer from the disease of compulsive overeating, and my life is unmanageable. There is a connection, but just solving that first problem does not take care of the second problem. Solving my compulsive overeating doesn't suddenly make my life manageable. That's what the rest of the steps are going to be about. So in that first instance, in that first step, they're really talking about, there's a couple things going on here. Yes, we have to really, you know, deal with the fire, put out the fire, which is our, you know, addiction. But then there's some other work that has to be done. And, you know, the second step came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And then the third step, turning our will and life over to the care of a higher power. I always read that as control, turning my will over to the control of a higher power. It's to the care of a higher power. So we think about how am I cared for? How do I want to be cared for by a higher power? That's not how I approached this concept of coming up with a higher power, and how does that a higher power, how am I going to turn to that and ask for help and have it interact with my in my life? It was certainly not thinking about it from a care perspective. So, you know, sometimes just looking at the words and the steps and really meditating on the words is so important. You know, someone described it, and I think it's a really great way to think about the first three steps, because they seem so inaccessible. If you're new or not so new, the steps, reading them, you go, okay, great. What does that mean? You know, we sort of have to substitute different ideas to make the steps accessible. The greatest thing for me is step one is go to a meeting. Step two is raise your hand and ask for help. Step three is follow the direction that's given. That's a really easy way to take a look at steps one, two, and three. Get engaged, ask for help, follow direction. That's it, I think, at the base, the easiest way to think about the steps. So there's a lot of tools that people use. I've seen in the program, you know, in terms of how am I powerless over food or food activities. And, you know, people have very, very different concepts. And they come in with very, you know, some people, for me it was sugar, chocolate. Other people don't have a problem with sugar. They have a problem with fried food. Other people have a problem with drive-ins. I knew someone whose abstinence was they did not eat standing up. They did not eat in a car. You know, it was a very, very specific activities that they had to remove. Not necessarily food, but actually specific activities. And a lot of people use the red light, the green light, the yellow light concept of foods. Green light, all the food I can eat, there's never a problem. I don't overeat it. I don't crave it. There's no obsession. We all know what those are. Yellow light, those are the foods that, you know, I can usually have, but sometimes there's an issue. I can have bagels, but, you know, if there's some turmoil or I don't know what's going on, or I find myself wanting to have a second bagel or wanting bagels every single day, maybe it's time to lay off the bagels for a little while. You know, it's a yellow light. It's a food that every once in a while can cause problems, so I have to watch it. But most of the time, it can stay in my abstinence. And, of course, we have the red light foods that no matter what, if I start down that path of eating those foods, I have no control. You know, I then become the obsession, the physical allergy. I want that. My body craves it. I obsess on it until I get it. Then I get it. Then I want more. And it begins that cycle. So those are the foods that I have to stay away from. I found it, you know, my mother came, as I said, both my parents were in OA. Neither of them stayed in the program of OA. My father stayed in AA, and would go back and forth with Owe, and every, you know, like, okay, I really got to work on this food thing. And he'd go to a couple of meetings. Never quite got it, but my mother was always a compulsive overeater. She's now in a nursing home, has Alzheimer's, a little bit more dementia than Alzheimer's. And, you know, I always thought, wow, what a curious test it would be in OA as the population ages. If you get Alzheimer's, do you forget that you're a compulsive overeater? Do you forget that certain foods are going to trigger you? You know, and of course, it's a nursing home, and she's in a great spot. You know, they say, everything's great, the only thing is, your mother just wants to eat off of everyone else's plate. And she just does not, you know, she's constantly asking for food. So I thought, okay, well, at least in her instance, she, you know, even though she's forgotten a lot of things, she hasn't forgotten that she's a compulsive overeater. That desire, that thing is still there. And but I have known other people in the program, and they go on to eat things that they couldn't eat when they were all there. So, who knows? The thing of it is, in terms of that, you know, the exercise, a lot of people think about getting down to figuring out what foods are trigger foods, which foods are not trigger foods, also what activities. You know, a lot of times it can be the food's not a problem, but it is in a certain environment, like going through drive-thrus. Some people don't go to anywhere where there's a drive-thru to get food. Or standing up and eating. It could be a certain activity that takes place that is also triggering. And so that also can be included. And we all know pretty, I don't think there's like a lot of surprises when we make this list. We all kind of know the foods that trigger us. I mean, it's, you know, and over time sometimes, you know, there's still some denial and it's like, oh, wow, you know, I can't have pizza. You know, I just discover. And that those will happen over time. But for the most part, we kind of know what we can have and what we can't have. So that is one thing that is, as we're starting to get into the first step in powerless over food, that's something that is very important to establish. I think the other thing, too, is having a type of sponsor. You know, when I was, before I came into the program and I go to, you know, lunch and dinner and breakfast with the people in my dormitory, I'm like, can I have this, can I have that? I mean, I was turning over what I could have to somebody else. I was making, allowing somebody else to make a decision for me. And I think that's so much of life today for me. You know, I lost a lot of weight. I was compulsively exercising. You know, I'm down to 144 pounds and still, you know, working out at the gym and thinking I needed to be thinner. And, you know, when fast forward to about 2002 when the doctor told me, you got to begin running marathons. There was a big thing in the 1980s in OA of not exercising because there were so many compulsive exercisers coming into OA. It was almost like, well, maybe you should lay off the exercise for a while because there was a serious, you know, bout of exercise bulimia going on. And so I didn't really exercise that much through the 90s. And so when the doctor said start running marathons, I was a little worried, you know, that I'd become obsessed about that again. And the thing that I discovered is I turn over my exercise. I found a running plan. I actually went to a running camp, and it was fascinating. It was like almost coming to like an OA convention. You have these sessions. I'm like, how can I spend a whole weekend talking about running? You know, and it was this Olympian guy who did it. And it was fascinating. Everything I thought I knew about running, I was completely wrong on this. And it was, and all the misconceptions, you know, everything you hear in the press, it was wrong. It's kind of like OA, you know? And what was interesting was there was a plan. Okay, this is how much you're going to run this day, this is how much you're going to run that day, and this is how you're going to do it. And it was fascinating because there all I had to do was look at the plan. I didn't have to think about, oh my gosh, you know, I'm 3 pounds heavier today. I think I need to do a 15-mile run. No, it's okay. Today, I'm supposed to run 12 miles. Then later in the week, I'm going to run 2 miles. So I follow a plan. I turn my running over to someone who's come up with a plan that's sane and works. And then, you know, when I was there with him, we would sort of adjust it. And he'd say, well, based upon what you're doing, this is what I'd recommend. And I discovered, surprise, I was running too much, you know. And this guy was a famous Olympian. He's running 100, 150 miles a week training, and he was always injured. And there was another guy who was doing much better than he was, and he talked to him, and he could never quite beat this guy. And the guy said, he says, how much are you training? He goes, well, I just run 30 miles a week, which is basically one long run. You know, a marathon's 26 miles. And he thought, how can he do that? Sure enough, he changed his training. He stopped training as much. He stopped getting injured, and he was able to run better. Huh. So this more and harder, longer idea that I walk around with, some of it's a little puritanical, you know, punishment. You know, you're not getting stronger or more fit unless it really hurts. I'm not losing weight unless I'm hungry all the time. You know, these I walk around with these self-punishing ideas of how I'm going to get better. So it was interesting to hear that from this guy. And so for my running, I follow the plan. It is whatever the plan is, you know, unless it's, you know, really, really bad weather, I'm doing that plan. And working out at the gym, you know, I'd work out at the gym. Of course, at a certain point, injured myself because I wasn't working out correctly. I was using too heavy weights. I finally said, okay, I'm going to get a trainer. And I have a trainer. So whatever the trainer decides that day, that's what I do. So I turn my exercise over to other people, a power greater than myself, people who know better than I do. So I'm not in charge of my exercise anymore. I got rid of the membership at the gym. The only time I go is when I work out with my trainer, and then I run and I follow a plan. It's very simple. So I don't have to be in charge of that. With my food, you know, it has evolved over time. And I think it's really important, right? We spend a lot of time in the program talking about, and we'll have a chance for everyone to sort of come up and share their experience with this, abstinence versus a food plan. For 20 years, I thought they were the same thing, and they're not. And it's a really, 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 really important distinction that I think is not talked enough about in the program. You know, if you're an alcoholic, you stop drinking. Oh, it's easy. And I'm not sure there's a little bit of self-pity, I find, in that, you know, the compulsive overeaters are like, well, you know, the alcoholics, they just have to stop drinking, you know, and that's it. We got to slay the dragon three times a day, and it's not fair. And I had a sponsee in AA who was going through very, very bad cancer that ultimately killed him. And, you know, he was taking a lot of opioids, and he got a prescription for his doctor for medical marijuana. He was 26 years clean and sober, and, you know, I'm giving him the medical marijuana, and he's taking a huge amount of opioids. And the question, you know, he asks is, am I sober? Yeah. And he wasn't getting a high off of this stuff. He was doing it because it was medically necessary. The pain was too great. So, in a sense, it really made me think about compulsive overeating. Here was a guy who had to take all of these drugs that technically would make him not sober in order to keep him alive. And he was sober because it was his intention and how he was using it, and it was under a doctor's orders. It was not him sort of deciding, hey, I need more of this stuff because it's great. And it reminded me that, okay, this is a little bit like compulsive overeating. He had to get into it and really be with the dangerous stuff, so to speak, but he had turned it over. His decisions were made by a medical doctor. He wasn't making the decisions. So with a food plan, I don't always have to make these decisions. I don't have to do this on my own. You know, we can do together what I can't do on my own. And that is a great way to approach the food plan. It's when I really don't want to tell my sponsor that I know I'm in trouble. You know, I always have to think when I'm sitting down in front of a meal, what if my sponsor was going to join me for dinner? Would I amend this? Would I take a little bit off the plate? Would I not have, you know, this food item? You know, for me, that's sort of my level of honesty. If I'm comfortable with my sponsor sitting there eating the meal with me, then I know it's probably an abstinent meal. And believe me, my sponsor would make a comment. You know, if there was something on that plate that seemed a little out of the ordinary, let's put it that way. So when we get into the concept of developing an abstinence, I don't have to do it alone, or food plan. What am I going to eat on a daily basis? I don't have to do it alone. For me, You know, breakfast can be very, very wide ranging. I'm a ritual eater. I like to have the same thing every day, day in, day out, year in, year out. God forbid if the sugar-free granola is missing, or the yogurt, you know, is not in the fridge, and they, or you know, the kids know, don't touch that, you know. I'm very ritualistic, and so I have to sometimes change it up to change up that ritual and say, okay, the granola is not that important. I'm going to have eggs, you know, and some smoked salmon for breakfast. You know, I got to switch it up and force myself to do that, to not become so fixated on that particular food item. Because even the food item can be innocuous, can be healthy, can be good. But it's like, okay, I need to have that today. You know, again, it's that control, that obsession is still there. So I need to change it up and have a couple of different versions of a breakfast. And that I work out with the food, you know, with my sponsor. I don't have a food sponsor and a regular sponsor. I've used dietitians. Any of that, it can't hurt. So what I have to find out is, what are the foods that I'm going to eat that are going to nourish me? Portions. I don't always know what a good portion is or what's appropriate. And so I have to rely on somebody else. So again, it's relying on somebody else. And so I come up with, what can I have for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Can I have snacks? Some people have snacks, some people don't. I've had them, I've not had them. I'm very sort of open. I can eat pretty much whatever I want. I just have to stay away from the recreational sugar. And there are times when I'll make a phone call and say, you know what? I had the dinner an hour ago. I'm really hungry, and I'm going to commit. No more food. And there are days when I need to do that. And there's nothing shameful about it. It's not a reflection of my program. So what evolves from that is a food plan. What I generally eat, what I feel comfortable with, what are the things I'm going to stay away from, and you know, maybe the manner in which I eat them, you know, become important. And work that out with a food sponsor. Some people call in their food every single day. Some people weigh and measure. I got abstinent in Paris, France. When I finally moved to Paris, I got sober. I got to Paris, got a food sponsor. And she, you know, again, it was kilograms and grams and not, you know, ounces. So the whole food portion thing changed. And people were still using Gray Sheet for the most part, but we'd go through my food plan. I'm like, this is too much food. I'm going to put on a ton of weight. And she said, no, you're not. She goes, you've been doing this diet yo-yo for so many years. Your body doesn't know what it needs. Once you get onto a steady food plan and eat on a very consistent basis, you'll lose weight. Trust me, your body's going to adjust. And she was right. I mean, I had never eaten more food in my life. You know, I'd have a salad and two vegetables and a protein and some bread and a piece of fruit for dinner. You know, I mean, that was a lot of food at that point. And sure enough, after being very, very, very consistent, my weight did not go up. It actually came down, and it moderated. And it stayed very, very steady. As I got, you know, for me, what I discovered was, you know, the doctor had me running marathons. You know, I could eat a lot of food when I'm training. If I'm running over 17 miles at a time, the weight, you know, I could eat just about anything I wanted in any portion and keep my weight down. And about 2 or 3 years ago, I just got tired of running marathons. You know, I've done 15 of them. How many more? You know, I've done it. I do it to stay in shape. And then now the doctor was telling me, well, I had a new heart doctor, and the doctor's like, well, the evidence comes in that maybe this vigorous exercise for long periods of time is not so good. Maybe you should stop running marathons. And I go, yeah, after 15, now you tell me. thank you. It wasn't in me. I was really dreading it. And, you know, at a certain point, there needs to be joy in life. And I was not having joy at all. And I was not looking forward to, and I run the all my marathons when I was being in Los Angeles. I run them with my trainer. We run about 10 of them together. It became very much of a ritual thing, and we really enjoyed it. And I just dreaded it, and I didn't enjoy it. And I was running slower, you know, between 45 and 54, you run slower. And I was looking at the times, and I was more tired. You know, that's age. And I just finally really said, I don't want to run these long distances anymore. So I stop. Well, of course, the weight starts to come back on because I didn't change my eating. So I'm about 10 pounds above where I normally am. And I was about 15 pounds, now it's 10. And, you know, I panicked, as I mentioned, and my sponsor's like, well, you can go back to running more or eat a little less. What I discovered, and I'm like, why am I having this problem? I never had a problem for years in OA. What is going on? I'm not going to buy more clothes at a higher, larger size. You know, I want to sort of attack this. And he goes, well, you're getting older, so that the fact is, no matter what happens, you either need to eat less, your metabolism is slowing down, and it really has slowed down. And, you know, what I discovered was I started, without noticing it, eating out a lot, you know, and everyone was busy. You know, I'm working all day. My wife isn't working. She'd usually make dinner. Well, now she's the kids got all stuff. You know, she's running around with them. And so I'll just go pick up something. And I really discovered I was doing that five days a week at lunch. Same thing, going out and just, you know, grabbing a salad or a sandwich or whatever it is. The portions are always going to be bigger, and I'm not going to set aside some of that food. So I really hit upon, oh, I'm eating out for 70% of my meals. Maybe that has something to do with the weight gain. So I started making my lunch, trying to make a concerted effort to eat meals at home. And sure enough, very, very slowly, the weight begins to come down again. So it may not necessarily be, it is how I'm eating. You know, even today I have to look at that. And I think, gee, I've been in the program this long. How come I can't have my weight, why can't I have control over my weight? You know, it comes back to that first step thing again. So, working on the food plan, but that's not my abstinence. Part of my abstinence is looking at what else do I do on a daily basis that's going to keep me in recovery? That is my abstinence. So I have to have a food plan. That's the ticket to admission. I have to be honest with what I'm putting into my mouth. Doesn't have to be perfect. You know, if I have an extra piece of chicken or I have a piece of bread when I don't normally have a piece of bread, that's not a big deal. But if I start having a piece of bread at every single, extra piece of bread at every single meal, and it starts, you know, snowballing, then I need to talk to my sponsor about it. You know, it's not about having the perfect meal. It's about eating sanely. So, food plan. What else am I doing that I have to maintain my spiritual connection on a daily basis? I need to meditate every day. And so, I don't meditate. I've got ADHD, I'm sure, undiagnosed. But I can't sit there for 20 minutes. But I can do 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 minutes meditation every morning. And I've really come to rely on that. So daily meditation is part of my abstinence. Having a sponsor. I went so many years without a sponsor. I needed to make having a sponsor part of my abstinence. So that's another part of my... If I don't have a sponsor, I'm not abstinent. It's very, very important. I need that other person to sound, bounce things off of and to talk to and rely on. You know, I may not talk to my sponsor about working out. I've got a trainer for that, but I have to have that sponsor, that other person. I'm not doing it alone. I also have to sponsor people. That's part of my abstinence. If I'm not carrying the message, I'm not in recovery. So I need that to be part of my abstinence. Exercise on a regular basis. Just because I'm not running marathons, I still have to stay physically active. Work out with a trainer twice a week. I run 2 to 3 times a week. So that is, when I can, I bicycle to work once a week. So all of that is, it's not rigid. If I don't bicycle to work, you know, it's not a big deal. You know, it's not that I'm not abstinent. It's just on a consistent basis that I'm doing the exercise. So if I'm doing all those things and I have a food plan that I'm generally following, I'm abstinent. Because in the old days, abstinence was gray sheet, and you followed this plan, and you're either abstinent or you're not. And if you weren't, and it was very easy, I had a piece of bread, well, that wasn't on the food plan, you're not abstinent, start all over again. And everyone had 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, because it was focused on the perfection. It was focused on you know, one specific aspect of the program. And I'm going to get very political here. This is very controversial. This is my opinion. This is not the opinion of OA or any other entity. It is my opinion, 1,000%. You know, in the late 90s, you know, when it basically OA moved away from having sponsored food plans. Some of that was for legal liability reasons. Part of it was a recognition that, you know, two or three food plans are not going to cover the entire population. Everyone has different needs, they have different issues, and for us to say that this is abstinence and if you're not following this, you're not abstinent, really didn't make sense. And then out of that, people said, well, how do we know that people are going to really be in recovery? They're going to be lying to themselves. They're compulsive overeaters. They're liars. Come on. You know, fat serenity. You know, that you'd hear this. So out of that came groups to address that issue, like Hal, and again, basically using Gray Sheet. And we look at it, and within the late 90s, there was some real schism in the program. You had your Hal meetings, you had your OA meetings, Hal went off on its own, and there was a couple of variations like that. And I think it really, it derailed OA for a while. I think that it really people got consumed with this. And fast forward 20 years, Hal is not really that popular. There's not that many meetings. I mean, I look at it in Los Angeles, I look at it in New York, I look at the meetings in Washington, D.C. Are there meetings? Yes, absolutely. But I don't see the numbers in recovery in the same manner as I do in OA. And it's not to say, see, doesn't work. I'm more interested in why. That should work. If I'm focused on what I'm putting into my mouth, abstinence equals recovery. Intellectually speaking, focusing on the food plan should produce better results. And it didn't. Otherwise, you'd have 90% of the meetings be Hal, 10% would be OA. Today it's 2% Hal, something like that, from what I can tell. And what it is focusing just on the food ignores the real issue. The food is the entrance. If we don't tackle the food, then we're not going to get recovery anywhere else. But if we stop at the food and what's on the plate, there's no recovery. You know, it's that I'm powerless over food and my life's unmanageable. Not because I'm powerless. My life is not manageable because I'm powerless over food. It's unmanageable for a wide variety of issues, including being powerless over food. But if I deal with the food, there are no miracles, except maybe I might lose weight. But then I'll start to lose weight and think, oh my God, what's going to happen when I lose the weight? I don't want this attention. I don't like this person. This person is giving me more attention. How do I get rid of them? I don't want to deal with this. Deep down inside, I'm really an awful person. So I'm thin and people think somehow I'm a better person. I'm not. I'm really an awful person. And I start self-sabotaging myself. None of that stuff gets addressed in the food plan. But if my focus is the food plan, I'm never going to address that other stuff. So I'm powerless over food and my life is unmanageable. So that's where the concept of abstinence becomes much more important than having a specific food plan. And the food plan is a component of abstinence. And if it's Gray Sheet, wonderful. If it's a Hal-based abstinence, wonderful. If that works, fantastic. But it can't be my sole focus. I have to include everything else, spiritual, having a sponsor for me. And so the thing I think to think about and what we're going to get into with the discussion is, how is my abstinence different than my food plan? And what do I need on a daily basis to be in position to recover? What are the things that I need in my life and my program today that are going to put me in position to begin working step two? Step three, you know, basically step two is I'm not in charge. You know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. That implies we're crazy. You know, basically, I can't run the show. So if I get a sponsor, I turn my food over. Sometimes you can do it on a daily basis. I did not weigh and measure because when I got abstinent in Paris, you don't walk into a restaurant with a scale. they will throw you out. You don't even ask for substitutions. They're like, you come here because you want the food prepared the way the chef makes it. If you want the food the way you want it, go home. I mean, it makes sense on a certain level. That's the way the French are. I mean, you know, and there were certain restaurants. There was a very famous restaurant. My sponsor's like, okay, I think we can get in here. I know the proprietor of the restaurant. She likes me, so we'll get a table. And she would look at you, and she'd be like, salad, viande. Yeah, she would tell you what you were eating for lunch that day. But it was so good, you put up with it, because whatever you got was going to be wonderful. And, you know, or if you ordered something, I mean, it was quite typical for the waiter to make a comment like, you know, I think that's a lot of food. It was, the French are very, very upfront about body image, which is very jarring for Americans. When I was there in 2016, I'd just gotten off the plane. I was a little jet lagged, and I was with my family, and we were going somewhere, and I jumped up to stand on sort of a low wall, about a foot or two, to take a picture. And I couldn't, you know, I was a little too tired, and I didn't quite make jump up like on that little step, and I hit my shin and gashed it, and it started bleeding a lot. And so I went to the pharmacy, and the guy goes, "No, you need to go to the hospital." Okay. So there was a hospital nearby, so we went over to the hospital. And at this point, I had stopped. You know, I was in my, I'm not sure, 101 marathons. I was probably, I'd say, about 10 pounds heavier than I am now. So it's a little bit heavier. So I started talking to the doctor, and this is what happened. And, you know, I could speak French. And I said, "It's crazy." I said, "You know, last time I was in Paris, I ran the marathon here. And I get off the plane, and I can't even jump up on a step, and I injure myself." And he goes, "You're in a marathon?" I go, "Yeah, I've run 15 of them." He goes, "You look a little fat to be running marathons." And I just laughed. I just was like, "Oh, yeah, the French, they just, you know." And in his mind, he's right. I'm an American. We're bigger people than the French. They're small-boned people. And people who run marathons in Paris, if you go see a marathon here in America, it used to be the LA Marathon, I'm sure Portland has one, everybody, you know, it's this thing of anybody can do it. Let's get a goal, let's go out and do it, and let's run that marathon. And a lot of people are first-timers, and there's something about the American psyche, whether it's weekend warrior or whatever, go out and achieve a goal. And in France, if you're part of a running club and you're very committed, then you're going to run a marathon. You are a serious runner. Everyone will finish the race in a quicker time. You have very few first-timers out there because it is the serious runners that are out there. Not the people who are like, "You know what? I just decided I was going to do this, and I trained for 6 months, and now I'm running it." So it's a different type. It's a much more broad group of people that are running marathons in America than France. So from his standpoint, he was right. I did look kind of fat to be running marathons, you know, as compared to the French runners. You know, the recovery was, I laughed. I was not offended in the least. It was like, okay, that's that French difference. And, you know, so imagine bringing in a scale if you weigh and measure. That's not going to happen. And so I did not learn that way of a food plan when I was living in Paris the first 2 years. So I don't weigh and measure. Although in the mornings, I do measure out, you know, how much yogurt and how much granola I have, because I discovered it was becoming a very, very big bowl of food. And, you know, I look and say, okay, maybe a half cup of yogurt is really all I need, you know. And so that I will do, because I notice in the morning that that bowl of yogurt was getting pretty large. So, and that was part of the thing, saying, okay, when I needed to look at the weight that wasn't coming off, what are some of the things I need to do? And apart from not eating in restaurants, it was that. So this whole concept of abstinence versus food plan, I think, is so central, you know. And then turning it over to a sponsor and being in contact, maybe not on a daily basis. I don't think there's any rule that says you have to talk to your sponsor every single day. It's helpful. I know a guy has more time than I have. He has like 35 years. He's talking to my, you know, we share the same sponsor. He talks to him every morning. He does his reading, his writing, and does all that. I don't write. I con myself. I make the writing look really nice, and, well, it's almost like a story, and because I had to do writing for a living for a while. So it's very hard for me just to sit down and write. And I write, and that is not where the answer comes for me, often, except in the inventory process, which is a very specific way of writing, which we'll get into when we get into a mental. So doing that, and then when we get into the third step, turning our will and lives over to the care of a higher power, not control. So do I want to be cared for? I think everyone wants to be cared for on some level. And, there again, it's as simple as sometimes following the direction that's given. I'm going to trust, I can't say that all the sponsors that I've had have given me good direction. I sometimes ask for advice. When I was sponsoring people early on, I'm like, you do this, you do that. I was a tough sponsor, I was a yeller. What do you mean? You didn't do that. I told you to write that inventory. You call me when that inventory's done, click. That's the way I used to be. I was a tough sponsor, and people would seek me out. I was angry, and I feel horrible at how I treated people back then. And the reality of it was, today it's like, well, I think you need to do some writing on this. So you don't do the writing. I don't say, so, you didn't do that writing. How do you feel? I don't bring it up. It's up to them. They can either recover or not recover. I'm making a suggestion. Should I stay in this job or not? I have a sponsee who's going back and forth, and I go, well, I don't know. I'm not God. This might you stay there, you might just zoom up and become head of the company, or maybe you need to leave and go off and do something else. I don't know what the right thing is, but let's bring God into the picture. Let's pray about it, and let's look for some direction. And why don't you sit down and do some writing and say, let's talk about the problems you're having with this job, because it sounds like you have a lot of resentment. And let's get into the inventory process on this and find out, are you resentful at yourself for staying in this position? Or are you resentful at the company because they're not really utilizing what you feel are your skill sets and in a more full manner? I don't know. I said, go do the writing, see what comes up, and we'll go from there. He came back, we did the writing, it became very clear in his writing, and he goes, yeah, I need to find a new job. Great, God worked. I didn't have to get involved. I'm just a facilitator. And so that's the third step. I don't have to rely on the program. I will come to the program for the answers, and there's a collective wisdom, and I do find direction. That's what the third step for me is a lot of the time. But, and that helps in terms of abstinence and everything else, is that physical recovery. The other part of the physical recovery that we'll get into is, okay, I'm the weight that I am. This is where God wants me to be. What is God's will? As a sponsor used to say, open your eyes. It's happening. Right now. This is God's will. I'm like, well, what if it's horrible? There's bombings and stuff and terrorist attacks. That's God's will. He goes, God's will. It's what's happening right now. It's your decision how you're going to react to this that is going to determine, how this impacts you. But this is, your job is to be in acceptance and figure out your role. So if you want to know what God's will is, open your eyes. I'm this weight. This is exactly where God wants me to be. What's the difference between fat serenity and acceptance? You heard a lot about that. Well, I binge today, but I love myself, and I'm just going to keep back, go to meetings, and turn it over. We hear that person or have been that person in the room for years. Well, if I'm supposed to accept myself where I am today, what's the difference between that and fat serenity? Say, well, this is where I am. I had to eat all that ice cream. And I think the difference is, am I abstinent and being honest or not abstinent? If I'm abstinent and I have a food plan that I'm following and I have the other components that I've decided are part of my abstinence that I've worked out with a sponsor and I'm in recovery, then yes, I am exactly where I am and I'm not in fat serenity. Versus, lying to myself. And I think it's really about intention. And, do I like the fact that I'm heavier than I was? Or people are like, hey, you put on weight. What's going on? Well, I stopped running marathons. You know? And I haven't adjusted how I eat. And I'm 53. So it's going to take a little bit of time for that weight to slowly come off. Now, I could do the crazy diet. My trainer, you know, I've kind of explained to him the program. He does not get it. But it's not his job to get it. Not his thing. His thing is help, you know, get me in shape and, you know, work on, you know, getting stronger without injuring myself. And so it's not his job to understand that. I go to a food sponsor, and slowly but surely the weight will come off. Because if I go, well, if I cut this out and cut that out, then I get into the diet mentality. And at the end game for me and the diet mentality is, then, once I can go away, I can start. Then I start all the way back, and then, you know, it's like the rubber band, you know. You get that one day at goal weight, and I can go celebrate. And that's the insanity, because we know it. We've been through that cycle so many times. So if I don't go on a diet, I don't get to that point where I can go back to those things. I adjust my food to live in a normal way that I feel comfortable and I don't feel deprived. And you know what? It's going to take a little bit longer for that weight to come off. That's okay, because that's where I'm supposed to be. And, you know, I look at pictures, past pictures of myself. I've been going through all these photo albums. I've been closing up my mother's house. And, you know, I love looking at these pictures when I thought I was fat. You know, what is it? I wish I was as thin as I was when I thought I was fat. You know, it's, and I have to stop and think and say, how much of this is my, you know, harsh critical judgment, and how much of it is a true vision of who I am? I can't tell. So today, I have to fall back on, am I abstinent? Okay. And at a certain point, when I get abstinent, if nothing's happening and I'm staying the same weight and I do know that there's more weight that has to come off, you know, I'll say to my sponsor, we'll have a discussion about it. Do I need to be doing something more? And we'll have a discussion about it. At least I'm being open and honest. But that's where I think the thing is about with body acceptance. And we'll get into a little bit more of that in the emotional part, but the physical part is almost that checklist abstinence. Have I gone to a meeting? Do I have a sponsor? Am I making outreach calls? Am I following a food plan? Am I having some form of exercise if that's important for me? Have I done all those things? Yes. Okay, you're done. I'm done. I now have to turn it over and live my life. It's now up for the higher power to make a decision as to whether I'm going to lose the weight. And at the end of the day, it's calories in and calories out. And so either I'm burning more calories than I'm taking in, or I'm not. And then maybe I have to make an adjustment. And I don't have to get crazy about it, and I don't have to beat myself up about it. It's not a moral issue. And I love making everything a moral issue. Mm-hmm. You know? And you hear people in program, well, you know, he got fired from his job, lost his house, his wife left him. He must not be working a very good program. You know, for all that to happen. Something must be wrong. And maybe it's God's plan. You know, that he was supposed to be fired from his job and lost his house and his wife left him. You know, maybe he had a rotten marriage and was in a job that really he should have left 10 years before. And this is all part of God's plan, and there's something really quite miraculous waiting for this person down the road. So I can't take what's happening today and sort of say, oh, this is the way it should be or not be, or this is good or this is bad. It is what it is. And it's the same with my weight. I weigh myself once a month now. And I'll tell my sponsor. He goes, what is it? You know, and for months, nothing. I'm like, 193, 193, 193, 193. Now it was 189. My mind says, oh, good. Now you can go out and have something really nice for lunch. No. It is what it is. So I just stay on the path. And next month, August 1, I'll see what my weight is. Could be higher, could be lower. You know, how is my opinion of myself going to change based upon that number on the scale? And that's the thing that I have to get back to in emotional recovery, is that I should feel the same way about myself whether I'm 193, 189, 180. You know, am I working? Do I have a plan in place? Do I have that physical plan in place? That's where it starts. Once I can do that, and then the fog begins to clear, and it's very, in some ways, it can be very mechanical. then I can work on the rest of the steps.